Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation with Melissa Harris-Perry, I have to remind you, support for the Mark Steiner Show comes in part from the Maryland State Education Association. The Maryland Dream Act makes sure kids who graduated from a Maryland high school and whose parents have paid taxes for at least 3 years can pay in-state tuition. So whether you agree with it or not, we want you to vote on November the 6th. You have to vote.
Voters
get to determine if some of our Maryland students can seek a higher education. More information about ballot question 4 can be found at educatingmarylandkids.org. And now we'd like to introduce to you our guest here for the last part of our program. We're just pleased to have her with us, Melissa Harris-Perry, professor of political science at Tulane University, of course, host of the Melissa Harris-Perry Show every Saturday and Sunday morning at 10 a.m. here in Eastern Standard Time on MSNBC, and author of Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. And Melissa, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
How are you?
Oh, busy. You know, there's this election thing going on.
Oh, there's there?
I don't know if you heard.
This election thing going on, I think, you know, when you look at things that people say, and you talked a bit about this in your book as well, about Michelle Obama, your book is just dead on it. I mean, I think about the constraining stereotypes you wrote about in this book, the nurturing mammy, the lascivious Jezebel, or the stiff-necked, unruly matriarch that this society has thrown on black women. And I think about Michelle Obama and how she's stuck in that crooked room sometimes.
Yeah, so, you know, in the book, I lay out this notion of a crooked room and the idea that part of what African-American women are dealing with is what we already know, the resource disparities, the issue of having less access to education, lower income levels, far less access to wealth, kind of all of the things that we think of when we think of inequality in a very real resource way. But the other thing that African-American women are coping with are these race and gender stereotypes. And those stereotypes actually impact how we are received in the public world. So, you know, one of them that you just talked about is this idea of being angry. So if an African-American woman, for example, who's a state legislator, shows passion about voting rights, it can be easy for so many viewers or constituents or opponents to just write her off and say, oh, there's some black woman being mad again about something, but not have to actually account for the substance of the thing that she is angry about, because you can just kind of put her in the box of that stereotype. So I was interested in the book in playing that out, trying to think very carefully through how those stereotypes impact how black women are able to actually do politics. And the whole time that I was writing the book, of course, was long before Barack Obama was running for the U.S. presidency. In fact, at that time, I knew him as State Senator Obama. And then watching Michelle Obama go from Michelle Obama to First Lady Obama, and watching her in that transition to First Lady manage those stereotypes and how she decided to deal with them was, for me, just a fascinating kind of process politically.
So one of the things I think is really important, I'm going to get a couple of quotes that you from the book, just to kind of wrestle some things in the time we have together. This is important because, you know, we talk all the time about the strength of black women, and that becomes part of this game that's played. There's a reality and a game being played at the same time. And one of the things you write in here, strong is the default category for describing black women, but the myth leaves them sicker, less satisfied, and more burdened than any other group. That's a really important and, in some ways, difficult concept for many people to put their hands around.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm teaching a course this semester at Tulane on African-American women's politics, and just this week was our week on health and health disparities. And, you know, we can see, for example, that African-American women, babies born to African-American women, are almost twice as likely to die in their first year. The infant mortality rate is almost twice as high as for infants that are born to white women. One of the reasons, and it's a very complex set of reasons and insurance and access and all of that, but one of the reasons that researchers have found has to do with what we call the cumulative experience of discrimination and oppression. So that having experiences, even in childhood or adolescence or young adulthood, that feel like experiences of rejection based on race and gender can change the outcomes that black mothers have as long as 10 or 20 years later. So that, you know, one of the things that we see when we look back, for example, at women of my mother's generation, women who went through the era of Jim Crow, is that the experiences that they had then actually impact the life expectancy of their own children. That sense that there are real physical consequences for how oppression and inequality plays out, I think is important to keep bringing it back, because often in current public discourse, we'll hear things like, oh, you're just whining, or, oh, why do you keep bringing up race? And the answer is because race continues to have a meaningful impact on our lives, everything from our physical bodies to our politics, to our ability to, again, even to have families and to support those families.
You know, Melissa, I was thinking again as rereading the book, just to prepare for our time together today, I kept thinking about how relevant it is, though, for today, because one of the points that come up in the book that makes you think about in this book is that, you know, that whenever somebody talks about Michelle Obama, let's say, for example, and you talk about her being an angry black woman, or they bring up her Princeton thesis or any of those things, that we say, oh, look, you're making this about race again. So we can never have a conversation here that about race, because you're either saying, oh, it's 100% racist or not racist at all. And you can't, and we won't allow that balance in conversation to take place in the media or in this country at all.
Look, absolutely. And it's one of the things that that is difficult terrain for us to manage, because, look, racism is difficult for us to define because we have had such a hard time writing and thinking and talking about it as a country. So I always try to point out that you can have racial inequality or policies that create racial inequality, even if everybody is a person of goodwill, right? So even if everybody in the system is somebody who doesn't believe in racial inequality, who wants things to be better, nonetheless, because of our legacy, because of our history, you can have circumstances that reproduce racial inequality. So you have to be able to talk about race because it gets reproduced even if everyone is of goodwill. And that even if is a very big even if.
It's a huge
even if. Because the fact
if.
Is not everyone in the system is of goodwill, right? Not everyone is an actor
interested
in making sure that we have racial equality.
So if you were to take the book now and write a new preface or a new conclusion, given what's happened since the book has been written, with this presidency, what would you begin to think about and write about?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that, because my new preface, which is due in January for because it's coming out in paperback. I they had hoped that I would get it into them by now, and I said to them, I can't. I have to wait for the election to play out.
Yes.
You have to give me an opportunity to watch what the American people do as voters. And what I'll say is, you know, sort of no matter what, there's a stunning acceptance of First Lady Obama, a kind of not just acceptance but embrace of her, that I think is kind of an extraordinary example of her capacity to get people to be able to see themselves in her despite race. And that doesn't mean she transcends race. I hate that language. It's not about transcending race. It's just about her ability to get people to see their familiarity with her as a parent, as a woman. Now, part of how she's been able to do that is by staying out of partisan politics, by staying, you know, so even when they try to drag her in to kind of the partisan muck, she keeps kind of moving out of it and staying just on issue positions or just on sort of maternal and wifely positions. But the real question for me is whether or not an African-American woman can ever achieve the level of embrace that First Lady Michelle Obama has and take on political issues in a very forthright, direct way. You know, we saw even with Oprah Winfrey, who was, you know, the first emblematic example of an African-American woman totally embraced across racial lines, kind of in contemporary American stories, when she took on politics, when she backed the Obamas in 2008, she took real backlash as a result of that. And so the question is whether or not a black woman could stand her ground politically and continue to enjoy that sort of popularity across lines.
We're talking with Melissa Harris-Perry, of course, host of the Melissa Harris-Perry Show, Saturday and Sunday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on MSNBC. And we're talking about politics in America today and her book, Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America. We're going to take a very brief break to talk about your favorite public radio station and come right back with Melissa Harris-Perry. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are about to continue our conversation with Melissa Harris-Perry, of course, host of the Melissa Harris-Perry Show on MSNBC, author of the book Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, and a professor of political science at Tulane University. And Melissa, this is, by the way, it's been generous of you to make those offers on the books. We really appreciate that here. But I
am more than happy to do it. I have a long time member of public radio. I support and listen to public radio here in my own hometown and continue to support public radio stations in pretty much every city I've ever lived in.
Well, that's good. This is a good thing. One of the things that struck me about your book is I think there's so many important things in this book. We had a debate on this show just last week between four black ministers over marriage equality, which was a fascinating conversation mm-hmm. that we had. Very nuanced. Yep. But it made me think about the part in your book where you talk about the silence that black churches and black liberation theology in particular have on gender and why that happens. And there's a line you have which is women were expected to sit in the pews receiving messages from men in the pulpit. I love that line. And I think
That's right. In the call and response, women are meant to be the response, not the call.
Exactly.
Right.
Now that's
this has real implications for political leadership. I mean, we have to remember how important African American churches have been for political leadership. Now we have to be careful because it's not necessarily that the church itself has been particularly progressive. In fact, often church folks have had to fight their churches to be able to get out into the streets to do the kind of work that we often associate with civil rights and with progressive movements and labor movements and that sort of thing. But because so many of the leaders first cut their teeth around church leadership, the kind of gender inequalities that occur in the church can also show up again in our leadership politically. So it's one of the things, again, that I teach about is people like Septa McClark and Ella Baker, Diane Nash, women who were completely central to the civil rights movement. But as we have written down the history of the civil rights movement, as we have taught it, we continue to silence those women and their stories, and we don't tell them. And so when we don't tell their stories, we don't provide any kind of model for young women who are coming forward thinking to themselves, how can they contribute to their communities?
So I wonder, when you look at what you kind of, this is kind of scholarly but very kind of fundamental and rational and personal look in this book, and I think about this election we're going through now, and I think about how, you know, people don't want to say that race has to do with this election. Liberals don't want to talk about it, and conservatives don't want to talk about it. But it is there. And I was thinking about it because I was looking at some of the passages in your book, and thinking about how that you look at the lives of black women, and how that no matter what that means, that nexus of human and national identity that comes together. That this is it's an insight for all citizens to kind of figure out what our politics are, because it's inherently a political struggle, and that 44% of folks who voted for 44% of white people voted for Obama. Something's happening, and in some way,
look,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Melissa.
And look, the key is that we cannot be terrified when we hear that race has something to do with it. It's always, I think for me, one of the challenges in interracial conversations is for white Americans who have not yet really done the work of challenging privilege and thinking through race, and there are many white Americans who have, mm-hmm. but for those who haven't, when you first say, okay, look, we got to talk about how race plays in here, you can watch the freezing happen and the eyes dilate and just the silence. And it's as though when we're about to talk about race, people either feel such great fear because they don't want to say the wrong thing, or they feel such anger because they believe that they're about to be blamed for something that's out of their control, or they feel such confusion because we don't have the same vocabulary for talking about inequality across our differences. But we need not fear this dangerous territory because it exists. The idea that race is not part of American elections is willfully ignorant. you don't have to have a black guy on the ticket for that to be true, right? Race was an important part of Ronald Reagan's election and re-election.
Right.
Race was incredibly important to Bill Clinton's election and re-election. I mean, race is always there. It's like pretending that you don't see the drip coming from the ceiling of your house and you just keep walking past it or maybe putting a bucket under it. But folks, you know, if you don't, eventually your roof is going to cave in. You have to deal with it.
So what do you think, in the little bit of time we have left here, I just, you know, when in the book you talk about Entezake Shange, you talk about Zora Neale Hurston and many other incredible black women, cultural heroes, heroines of America and of the world. And so I'm curious what you ponder when you think about what those stories mean for all of America in terms of turning it around. Because because I think that there are many people who voted for Barack Obama and put that family in the White House because the racism, segregation, slavery, discrimination that this country was founded on, that became America, when they saw hope, they saw it embodied in a black family, and that did something psychologically to people. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think that the way you describe culture feeds into that, and that's a powerful thing.
It is, and it's incredibly powerful, and yet, and this is really the important part, and yet black folks are not magic.
Right.
And sort of, you know, making the decision to support a candidate across racial difference does not in and of itself heal racial inequality. And if you don't believe me, just ask all the African Americans who cast more than 90% of our votes for white people. I mean, the vast majority of the time that we vote for someone who is not of our same race. And yet we don't, you know, automatically bring about racial healing as a result. And I think part of the angst or inability to have an honest conversation about how race does factor in, both in keeping some folks from wanting to support the president because of their racial biases, but also leading other folks not to level critiques of the president
right.
and his policies
right.
because of their racial biases, right? It's complicated. It's not just a one key story here. And, but I guess what I'm hoping is that Sister Citizen is not overly celebratory of black women, suggesting that we are somehow magical creatures who could,
correct.
You know, with our great either mammy powers or something like heal the American racial narrative. No, we're not that. We're just, as the Combahee River Collective would say, we reject queenhood and pedestals and walking 10 paces behind. To be human, levelly human, is enough. And so what we're seeking here is full citizenship, which allows you to both have access to power and also access to failings, and to be able to be really great and yet inadequate and imperfect all at the same time, so that there's not some need to be Superman.
Melissa Harris Perry, let me just say that for our listeners here that what you just described, the way you can unravel the complexity and put it out there in very real words for people, is why your show is I think, and I'm not just blowing smoke, I think it's the best show on talk television today. And it's been. And thank you so much for joining us here this hour.
Well, I appreciate it. It's only great because I have guests like you who come and hang out, and it was a real pleasure. And I promise, as soon as you and I are off the air, I'm also making a donation because keeping you on the air matters a lot.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Take care and travel safe.
I will.
Melissa Harris Perry. You can hear her every Saturday and Sunday morning, 10 o'clock on MSNBC, Eastern Standard Time. And the book, Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, is about to be released in January, but we're going to tell you how you can get it here. She's a professor of political science at Tulane University, and I think one of our treasures in the media who says it like it is. On the way out of here, let me just say real fast, since we're leaving, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, go to www.mecu.com. And the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy, Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. We're engineered tonight by Andre Melton. Our interns are Latrice Eddy and Marissa Edmond. Our theme music is by Will Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, hear podcasts of our shows, and find information about our guests and the work they do, please come to our website at steinershow.org. Call 410-319-8888. Make those pledges now to WEAA and the Mark Steiner Show. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.